Here we are in Edmonds, Washington. It's Wednesday?
Yes.
It's Thursday. Thursday, July 24th. 4th, July 24th. We're talking to Betty Bell, and we'll start. We always ask a series of standard questions at the beginning, just so people can stop looking at the tape recorder and we can stop thinking. But you, what was your birthday?
My birthday? Mm-hmm. Oh, you want to know my age, the first question.
Yeah, isn't that terrible?
Well, December...
You look so much younger than you think.
Oh, yes. December 26,
1939. And where were you born?
Detroit, Michigan.
And your parents' occupation when you were born?
My father is a draw dye specialist. He was in tool and dye with the Ford Motor Company and his own business, tool and dye shop. My mother was a housewife.
Mm-hmm. And did you go to high school in Detroit?
Yes.
What high school did you go to?
Mackenzie High School.
And you graduated from there in...
1957.
Okay. When did you first hear... Did you go to college after
high school? Michigan State.
Michigan State. Oh.
Aha!
Aha! Okay, that explains something. Because I noticed on your the form you filled out that it said you took some courses on Southeast Asia and college.
Yes,
and
political science was my minor.
But there weren't very many places where you could do that. Yeah. Actually, Michigan State happened to be one of them.
Right. Dr. Fischel was instructor
That's F-I-S-C-H-E-L,
I believe. Was very influential in my falling in love with Southeast Asia from a distance.
Mm-hmm. How did you first encounter Southeast Asia in your undergraduate curriculum?
I don't really remember. Mm-hmm. I assume that it was some type of a survey course in Southeast Asian politics, because that is the area that I was minoring in.
Yeah, well, then we have to go back a little bit. Just another standard question. Did your parents have any religious orientation?
My father's a fallen away Catholic, and he is a German immigrant, and there were problems in Europe in the early 1900s when he was a young boy that did not set well with him. Mm-hmm. And my mother was Episcopalian, and we went to church occasionally.
Mm-hmm. So there was eventually no church connection between you and IVS?
No church connection at all.
Did you have any interest in international studies or working or living abroad before you?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. As a young girl, I used to sit on my bed with a set of encyclopedias that's still called Thailand Siam, and would dream of traveling. And that truly... was my motivation for getting involved in IVS. It was not altruistic at all. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see the world. I did not have the finances that I could do it without having some employment. And I was really interested in Southeast Asia. So when I had written to the placement service at the university saying that I had been teaching in California, and my first job out of college was teaching in Los Angeles school system. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote back at the university and said I'd like some jobs overseas. Here are my qualifications. Send me what kind of jobs are available. And so I heard about IVS through the placement service at Michigan State. And there were two or three other places that had they sent information about. But because IVS was involved in Southeast Asia, which is an area that I already had interest in, it was a natural for me to choose that one. So that's why I went.
Okay, well, to go back a little bit. So was there any, what do you think was the influence that led you to be interested in, like, sitting in a bed reading?
I think it might be genetic. Yeah. I don't my father was an adventurer. My father was born in Germany, went to Russia. This was all between the wars, World War I and World War II. Came back, came to the States. He came here by himself, didn't speak a word of English. You know, the whole immigrant story that's very typical. Was very successful. The world was just always... I never focused as much locally as I did on a world global look. And this was from, like, I was 8 and 10. So... since then, we have I have nieces and nephews that also are sort of the Harrison Ford of the family.
Oh,
you know?
So you're the Auntie Mame.
Yeah. And so I don't know if there's any genetic coding in there or not, but definitely the interest has always been global. And and curiosity, not to save the world. I mean, I have no illusions about being able to save the world. I can just save the environment that I can come in close contact with, in the sense that I can make it as good as I, whatever influence I have, can make it as good as it can be. But I have no great scope as far as doing any magnificent job. I think if I just do a good job at wherever I am, that's that contributes, and that's all we're talking about.
So when you went to Michigan State, what was your major going to be?
My major, well, you see, I wanted to go into the Foreign Service.
Okay,
and but in the 60s, it was still like, you're a woman, and the Foreign Service is not an appropriate choice. It's pie in the sky. Let's do something that you can be employed when you graduate. So I went into communication, which I and I got an education. I took enough classes in education to become a teacher, to get, you know, be qualified as a teacher. But I wasn't an education major. I always thought that was a waste of time. I thought you should be more up to date on whatever subject you were teaching, and the other things would come along. And so I taught public speaking, debating, drama. I was a drama coach in one of the schools that
after
I taught
you graduated.
In, after I graduated.
But while you were
right.
in school, you ended up taking some courses in Southeast Asia.
Right.
You remember, I think I just asked this, but do you remember why Southeast Asia as opposed to something
else? Well, because it was so exotic. It was so mysterious. Siam, when I was looking at those sets of encyclopedias that I had talked to you about, was the most exotic place I could think of. And, you know, as a 10-year-old. And so I wanted to go someplace, and I wanted to see the world, and I particularly wanted to see Asia. And the reason for that, as I say, it started at a very early age. But the Foreign Service, I was, I don't remember any specific thing, but for some reason I was discouraged in that direction. So I said, okay, I'll get a degree in education, I'll get a degree that I can teach with, and then I'd be able to go any place in the world as a teacher. And so that's what I did.
What was your degree finally? The actual
communication
type?
Arts.
Communication arts.
Yeah, that's what they called it at the time. And with a minor in political science. It was an odd combination.
But you had a minor in political science, and that is probably what led you to towards Wesley Fisher.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In fact, I even saw him in Japan. When we were in Japan, he was in Japan at the same time, and we had been communicating. So I ended up having breakfast with he and his family in Japan, and that was the last time I saw him, and that probably would have been in 62.
And
did you know him?
No.
Okay.
He's famous his name has slash come up? Infamous. No.
Oh, is he really?
Yes. Well, because of the Michigan team.
Okay.
They created the National Police Force.
Right, and, ZM.
And, under ZM. And
right.
There aren't many people my age who think that that was a... Anyway, a proper role for academics,
academics,
a success as a, in terms of, and the National Police Force was not a credit to, and it was a turned out. So it's a, it's really an, it's one of those worlds, so to speak. And they also did it. Berkeley did it in Indonesia. So they're known as the Berkeley Mafia amongst
those
kind of hypocritical or whatever.
He was a very, very nice man.
Yes, he's supposed to be very nice.
And excellent instructor, excellent teacher. And so he definitely continued to spark my interest. But my interest had been there
before
a long time before that.
What kind of the things you did for his classes? I think that's an interesting...
What did I do? Gosh.
Do you remember?
Term papers. Term papers.
Yeah.
And that was the only... And, you know, the exams. Most of the classes were reading and writing and examinations. And then lots of lectures where there was, you know, discussion. And, but oftentimes what we talked about as far as the lectures are concerned... was not directly applicable to the exams. I mean, that was like the icing on the cake, so to speak. And that was it.
And when did you start? When did you start Michigan State?
1957.
So you went from 57 to 61,
approximately. Yeah, graduated in 61.
61.
Went to California, got a job teaching in the Los Angeles School District.
We're not done yet.
Oh,
I was
okay.
interested in it because in that period, did Dr. Fischel go back and forth to Vietnam during that time?
I don't know that I would be aware of that.
Yeah.
I did not have that kind of a personal relationship.
He
was a professor. And then when I went to Vietnam or was going to Vietnam, I contacted him and told him I was going to be going over there. And he said, well, I'm going to be in Tokyo. And it turned out I was in Tokyo at the same time.
That
so
was
we
on
met
the flight
for breakfast.
Out?
I believe it was.
Right, okay.
Yeah, because I only was in Japan twice. Once when we went on leave after we'd been in country X number of months. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was on my way over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So you now we can get
move
up to
on.
Speed again, move on with the... you graduated with a degree in communication arts
right.
in 1961.
With education, high school education credits.
Credits. And you went to California?
Yes, Los Angeles.
All by yourself?
My girlfriend and I.
Oh.
Yeah. We took off in her TR3. You see, I have...
How romantic. I know it's two women, but...
Right. With $500 a piece and thought we were the richest women that had ever hit the West Coast. And, you know, I've always just had this sense of an adventure and this need, this really strong need to live not on the edge, because I certainly don't live on the edge of any kind of danger, but just there has to be some adventure and excitement in my life, or I'm not a happy camper.
Mm-hmm.
So off we went to California, and we left in August, and I didn't get a job teaching until October. So one of our favorite family, and I, in the meantime, had to have some income. So I got a job selling women's hats at the Broadway department store.
Where?
In, I want to say Reseda. I'm not positive, but I think it was Reseda. And so I called my mother and dad and said, oh, I got a job. And my dad said, where are you teaching? And I said, I'm selling women's hat. And he goes, oh, my God. You know, he didn't think that was quite appropriate. I said, well, this is just
but
a carryover.
In a department store.
Right. I mean, it was an interim thing.
A very large department store, too.
Yes. And so then I got a job teaching in October in Sun Valley.
In Sun Valley?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I taught out there from October... till school was out, and probably around Christmas time, I started saying, this is not what I want for my life. It's routine. It is okay. I like teaching. I always enjoyed my students, but it was not the lifestyle that I wanted. Go to work, come home from work, cook dinner, watch TV. That's not what I wanted at all. So
it's
that's
still not what I want, but it's amazing how
right.
I do it.
Yes. And
but only
so,
9 months out of the year.
Right. Okay. And so that's when I wrote the placement service at Michigan State. And then by that July, I was on my way to Vietnam.
You wrote to the placement service, and they suggested a variety of,
yes,
of options.
Right.
And including in those options was international IBS.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your when they told you about IBS? Was there enough explanation so you knew what it was? Or is it just an...
Oh, I think there must have been enough explanation because I signed all the papers.
No, that's a good answer. No, what I meant was, of the list of things that they gave to you, you chose IBS.
Because of the Southeast Asia connection.
Because it was Southeast Asia.
Right.
So in other words, with the information they gave you, led you to believe from that you would be going to Southeast Asia.
Right.
Because that's what they were doing. They were
absolutely.
Hiring people for
I never
Southeast
had
Asia.
Any, I mean, there was never a question of where I was going to go.
Right.
It was Southeast Asia, and it was
Vietnam. That was a perfect match.
Right.
Oh, that must have been exciting when you saw it.
It was. Everybody thought I was absolutely nuts.
And this would have been,
62.
Again, in 62, and it, okay, so it's 1962, you get this information, you right away, you get a letter back.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure I did.
Yeah. Oh yes. Did anyone interview you?
I don't remember.
Did anyone
that.
Call you on the phone? Did you talk to Dr. Nofsinger on the phone, perhaps? Did you?
I don't remember that.
Don't remember that.
No,
part?
I don't remember.
Did
that
you go to Washington?
No.
So you essentially you went from Los Angeles.
I went home with all of my belongings and deposited them at my mother's house, who was delighted to receive this. Boxes and boxes, and said hello and goodbye. Went to the dentist, make sure good all my thinking. Teeth were
yes, I do that too.
In yeah. good shape, uh-huh. and took off for Saturday. I then met all the other people that were going on in the same group.
Do you remember who they were? Or some of them?
Yeah, Billy Lee Langley, mm-hmm. Ann Wright. Billy Lee and Ann and I were the first three women that IVS had ever hired. Okay. Right. And we were, from their point of view, uh-huh. experimental, I'm sure. And Truman, somebody, and a picture. If I get my albums out, I might be able to remember some of them better. Forrest Garrettis. Have you heard
oh,
about
yes.
Forrest?
Oh, yes. I've interviewed him.
Okay. Right. And Jay Parsons. Mm-hmm. He's married to Ann.
Ann Wiley.
Ann Wright.
Wright, I'm sorry.
And Forrest and... Oh, Vince somebody. That's about all I can remember.
Well, actually, I have ways of making you remember all of those names.
Well, I have an album, and if
but
I...
That's why I'm not doing there's no particular
right,
reason.
Right, right.
So when you, no, this is, these are all history techniques where you
right.
say when you got on the plane, how much of the plane did you take up? And you'd say, oh, because there were only eight of us. I said, oh. See, like that. And you go, right in front of you.
Oh, see, I wouldn't
no,
remember.
No,
yeah.
no, but I'm saying there are these
yeah.
things. And by,
yes.
by the end, you know what clothes they were wearing.
Right,
it's
exactly.
very funny.
Yeah.
And without the use of drugs or psychiatry. Yeah.
yeah.
But the idea is that you flew to Tokyo mm-hmm. and stayed there a couple of days.
We all met in San Francisco. We uh-huh. had to get our yellow fever shots or mm-hmm. something, as I recall. And that's when I met Billy Lee and I met Ann and I met the rest of the guys that were going. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that there was maybe 8 to 12, mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah.
And so then we flew to Tokyo. And we were in Japan a couple days, 3 days, something like that. And I don't remember stopping anywhere else other than Vietnam. We may have stopped. Yes, we stopped in Hong Kong. And from Tokyo to Hong Kong. And then Hong Kong to Saigon.
What were your first impressions when you walked out of the airplane?
Well, I immediately loved Asia. Mm-hmm. I had absolutely no problem mm-hmm. making the transition from Detroit to Los Angeles to Saigon to mm-hmm. Quy Nhon.
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, I had a terrible transition coming back to the States.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about
yeah.
that. Well, do you know what the day you arrived in Vietnam, the date?
Mm-mm. It would have been in July.
July.
I know that I missed the 4th of July that year
okay.
because of crossing the date line.
Right.
And so it had to be...
July 3rd or 5th.
I've yeah, something that like that. But you know, but we spent
yeah.
2 days at least in Tokyo and
right.
we spent at least a day in Hong
so
Kong.
So it would have been like the 7th
So
or
it
8th.
Would have been later.
But of 1962.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. And were you met by anyone or... At the airport?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember who, mm-hmm. but there were some IVS guys.
And
that
you
were
went
there.
To IVS house?
Yes. They took us to the house. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what happened after that?
I don't specifically remember. Mm. I do remember impressions, and that was like none of these guys knew what to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
Here were three women. This had been a male world.
Mm-hmm.
And... they seemed uncomfortable and awkward and not quite sure what to include us in, what mm-hmm. not to include us in. And all of a sudden they had to, well, I don't know if they had to, but how can I say this? If you're in a male world and you have a locker room kind of thing when you sit around the table and you eat and you come to the table without a shirt on, you know, you do what guys do when they're with guys, and
mm-hmm.
then all of a sudden there's these three women that have intruded.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an unfriendly feeling, but it certainly wasn't one of great welcome.
Well, on the other hand, almost all these the people you would have met there would have been essentially...
Which proved to be, as time went on,
mm-hmm.
a real difference in our lives and mm-hmm. our attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I, you know, here I might be jumping too far ahead of you, but
mm-hmm.
when, but I found none of the men in IVS attractive as far as, I thought they were nice people. or not nice people, mm-hmm. whichever the case might have been. Mm-hmm. But none of them were of any romantic interest whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't go over to Vietnam with idea of finding any romantic interest, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, I didn't go over there to go into a monastery mm-hmm. or a convent. Mm-hmm. And so when I started dating some, particularly Fred, because the other guys were just people that I met and I go out with a few times, mm-hmm. and you know, then they would be transferred or something. There was no any strong interest. Mm-hmm. But when I met Fred, the comment, and I don't recall who, but and I don't even know if it was an attitude or if it was an actual statement, but like, why are you dating the military? Mm-hmm. And my comment was, you know, hey, I don't see anybody here I'm interested in dating, and I'm going to have a life, you know? And if you have any complaints about my work, I am more than happy to sit down and work it out. Mm-hmm. My personal life, as long as it is not trashy, mm-hmm. Is none of your business.
Mm-hmm. Why did they say? What do you think they meant by saying? Now, first of all, I don't have that information sheet in front of me, but you did years of service with IVS.
I did 18 months.
Okay, but you did 18 months, and then that was the whole sum of your IVS experience.
Right.
Okay, good. So we'll focus on that, because we know that we're looking from 62 roughly towards 64.
Right. Okay. Actually, it would have been 62. It might not have. It was a little over a year.
Much more.
And the only reason that I left before my contract was finished is because I had fallen in love and become engaged to Fred, mm-hmm. and he was rotating back to the States. He had been in country a year, mm-hmm. and it didn't seem like either one of us wanted to be separated for that, the rest of our tour.
Okay, so since somewhere between 62 and when you left, someone or people made you feel it. Why are you dating the military?
Right.
But why would they ask that question? What was the point of that?
Well, I don't know that they thought it was, I don't know what all of their political mindset was, because mm-hmm. I did not talk to everyone about their ideas about Vietnam, mm-hmm. and, you know, and so on. So, but I think it was because it was sort of like them and us. Mm-hmm. And I never had any antagonistic feelings towards the military from any personal experience, and so I was not anti-military, which I suspect there was a possibility that some of these guys were, mm-hmm. and because they were many of them, I think, because of religious associations, perhaps they were pacifists, perhaps this was their way of avoiding the draft. I never got into all of those things with these guys, but any of those are possibilities. They saw them as them and us, and I never did. And I just saw people I liked and people that I didn't like and people that I was indifferent towards. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any strong feeling one way or the other about them. And most of them fell into that indifferent category. Mm-hmm. And so I just ignored it all. I mean, I ignored their opinions and just did what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. As long as my work, as long as professionally I was doing what, and I love the Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can anybody be immersed in that culture, in that country, and not, I mean, they were gentle, they were thoughtful, they were bright. There wasn't anything not to like. And certainly on an individual basis, but I'm speaking as far as just a culture is concerned. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing my job well, I thought. And usually you are your own best critic. Mm-hmm. If you're goofing off or if you're doing something. And so what I was doing personally, which was by today's standards so innocuous, it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I dated. Mm-hmm.
Do you
want
to take that?
No.
Okay.
I just ignored them.
Mm-hmm. Here, 1 second. Then... probably for the record, by the way, A lot of that them and us was a bureaucratic, just had a person-to-person delivery to try to create a way of accessing of the American people. Military was that other way. So everything you said, I think, is probably valid.
Mm-hmm.
But also it was this idea that we're not them, so why do you want to have anything to do with them? You know, it's natural to do that, you know, mm-hmm. as in terms of why with your mission to such an extent that those that are not your mission become they're everything you're not,
right?
You know, like that, and or they're everything you're afraid that you will become. So
I just disagree with that whole pacifist.
Oh, sure. Well, it might not have been pacifist. But that raises an issue which I'd love to add. That's a good question to ask. You've taken courses in Southeast Asian political history
mm-hmm.
from Dr. Fischel, who may have had his own view.
He might have had his own agenda. That's right.
And you went to Vietnam, and you were going to be a teacher, and you were going to see a whole new world that you've been interested in all your life. And there was a war there.
Right.
You know, cooking away on the margins, you know. And you were dating military guys. They probably talked about the war occasionally. Impression of that as Vietnam is a
they were very frustrated because at the time that I was there they could only fire if hostile mm-hmm. fire was presented to them
mm-hmm.
so oftentimes they'd see situations that they felt were setting up troops for mm-hmm. difficulties but couldn't do anything about it because mm-hmm. It was against their peers, as mm-hmm. far as that kind of thing is concerned. Mm. So I think that was very frustrating. And I don't, you know, I'm sure you don't want to get into my whole philosophy Vietnam and all this sort of thing.
Oh, definitely want to. Yeah.
But through the years, this wasn't an attitude.
Oh, no. Let's go back to how you felt then.
At that time.
Yeah,
time. Yeah. Well, you see, if we both agree that war is immoral, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's an awful thing.
Mm.
However, I think there are times that it is required, it's necessary. We wouldn't be an independent nation. Mm. We wouldn't be the United States if there hadn't been a revolution. And so I'm not so naive to think...
Well, you weren't so naive.
Yes.
As to think.
To think that... that all these wonderful things that mankind can accomplish on a technological level, that he deals with well on an emotional level. And so I think man has advanced in the technological mm-hmm. field. I don't think he's advanced emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
That's my mm-hmm. opinion at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think war is sometimes really necessary, although I'm the first one to tell you that I think it's an awful atrocity.
Mm-hmm. But in Vietnam,
I think that at that time, I've always believed that communism mm-hmm. was... bad,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I saw that we were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no problem with fighting with the Communism, military in
right.
Vietnam.
Right.
No.
Okay. When you were there, in the short time you were there, what did the communists? How did you envision them? The people who are out there, who are the guys that you were sometimes dating, the IBS workers you were working with. The students, that environment. What did you think of that? The other out there, out in the jungles, and
I saw them as preying upon people in the villages. You know, mm-hmm. this is when they still had those strategic hamlets,
mm-hmm.
and so I saw them preying upon people with terrorist type tactics mm-hmm. that was not. War isn't honorable, but mm-hmm. what they were doing was very low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because of their tactics, mm-hmm. and I saw them as the Vietnamese people that I came in contact with in Quy Nhon, in Saigon, in Hue, which were the areas that I probably spent the most time in.
Mm-hmm.
Quy Nhon and Saigon being two most. None of them were, they were not anti-American.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't run into any, I mean, wherever the anti-American communists, Viet Cong were, it wasn't in the environment that I was working in. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even see it on the periphery. Mm-hmm. So I never felt unwanted. I never felt out of place. I never felt I know I was a foreigner, but I never felt foreign. Mm-hmm. In my environment, in my school's teaching situation with the other teachers. So I simply see the communists as being exploiters, mm-hmm. and being terrorists, mm-hmm. and having a political philosophy that reads well, but when man interprets it, mm-hmm. doesn't come out well at all.
And the Saigon regime that you were...
Oh, well, they were, I saw them as being very corrupt, as mm-hmm. ZM as being very... And Madam Nu, I got to meet Madam Nu.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about meeting Madam Nu.
We were in Dalat.
Anyone listening to the tape would kill me if I didn't follow that question.
Okay.
Right away.
I met her in Dalat, mm-hmm. and we were there for Christmas. Mm-hmm. It would have been Christmas of 62. Mm-hmm. And she had a villa that was just below, it was a terrace situation, mm-hmm. and it was just below the house that we were staying in. I don't recall if we were in an IVS house or if we were in a rented house. I don't recall.
Mm-hmm. That was the IVS house.
Was it at the IVS house? Was just below that. Mm-hmm. And so she was out in her yard, and we were up roasting hot dogs and marshmallows and singing camps, you know, just kind of mm-hmm. stuff. And so somebody saw her down there, and they said, oh, we should invite her to come up. So mm-hmm. they did. Mm-hmm. And she had never had marshmallows. Took the marshmallow off the stick and ate it and thought it was delicious, but of course it left a residue on the fingers of her gloves.
Could you repeat that? Because sometimes the tape takes a little time to start. So she came up to the house.
Right, yes. And we asked her if she'd like a hot dog, and uh-huh. she had, as I said, had these long black kid gloves on. So she took a roasted marshmallow off the stick uh-huh. and ate it and thought it was delicious, but it left a residue on her fingers, uh-huh. on the black kid gloves. Uh-huh. And I don't recall quite how she resolved that, but I do remember this astonished look as she looked at her hand and saw the little white gooeys from the marshmallow on her black kid gloves. And so that was, but I have always had a problem with unchained authority. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with authority that I can, here it's a personal judgment, that I consider reasonable. Mm-hmm. But unchained authority is something that has never sat well with me. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, I did not respect or think well of either. I thought ZM was weak, mm-hmm. and I thought Madam Nu was a dragon.
Mm-hmm. Lady.
Dragon lady, right. And that was basically, you know, the blue laws, you couldn't dance. You know, we used to close our shutters and pay some kids some piastres and to be on the street just in case some of the, we called them the white mice, you know, mm-hmm. the police would come by. And
Wesley Fishel's National Police. Okay.
And you know, and then we dance and whatever, you know. I found that all very ridiculous and mm-hmm. of no
Well, tell me about those blue laws. What were they?
Well, I don't know how they affected the Vietnamese people, and I don't know. All I knew was that we couldn't dance, mm-hmm. that we had a curfew at 9 o'clock curfew. Mm-hmm.
These are for IBSers.
This was for the whole country.
Okay.
No, this had nothing to do with IBS. Right. I mean, these were national laws, mm-hmm. that, you know, we could not avoid just simply because we weren't mm-hmm. Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And So the curfew and the dancing are the two things that I recall, mm-hmm. that we were 9 o'clock. The night I was engaged, mm-hmm. I had to be home by 9 o'clock, and Fred couldn't bring me home because he wasn't the officer of the day. So his friend, who was the officer of the day, drove me home in a Jeep, mm-hmm. and I was home in bed at 9:30 the night I was engaged. Because I couldn't spend any more time with Fred because of the blue laws. And at that time, and I recall that if you were out after 9 o'clock, you were shot on sight.
Hmm.
So. So, it wasn't a good idea.
No, it wasn't a good idea. Going back to Madame New,
yes.
I have a theory.
Yes.
In 1963, actually here in 1962, there was the famous Buddhist meeting of some monks, and very famous expression.
Okay.
And I have always wondered where she learned the word
barbecue.
And yet, earlier that year, about two months before, she had actually never been to one before.
Okay.
Because everyone tells the same story of those kid gloves.
Oh, they do?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's very interesting. And, you know, and her astonishment, you know, that...
Yes.
How does that happen?
You right.
know, that kind of thing. So we just wonder whether... Well, in our interviews, we might meet the person who said, and she asked me what this was, and I told her it was the 4th of July, or Christmas, or whatever.
It was Christmas.
It was Christmas, and we always call this a barbecue.
Yeah, no, I don't, because I remember hot dogs, and I remember marshmallows, and I don't associate either one of those particularly with a barbecue.
Oh, that's a barbecue.
But I'm sure it is. It was outside, right? It was outside, but I think of ribs.
True. But she would have, you know, the question is she might have asked someone.
Right. And you know, I don't recall.
Not even
that.
IBS. She could have asked one of her interpreters
right.
or someone else.
Yeah,
but,
I don't recall.
But she spoke English.
But yes.
So,
oh, yes.
So there was
And everybody else remembers the same story. Isn't that interesting?
Well, some more or less. But
right.
Her gloves.
Mm-hmm.
I think one, I don't know, I'm not sure. I think someone might have said white gloves. But I may be.
But I have a picture.
But you have a picture. Well,
so I'll show it to you
that
later.
That is a picture we have to see.
Yes,
that's a picture that it's
of Madame New.
It fills in this gap and actually
right.
brings IVS right up into the historical record of the seminal event. I
right.
think of the whole war is the death of Diem because
right.
there's a vacuum that follows and never is filled. So. Now you also said that we might as well do this now since we're on the roll. Which is that you had a general feelings about the war that you eventually evolved.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I'd love to hear those.
Okay, well, actually, as I said, if we can make the premise, if we can agree on the premise that war is immoral, mm-hmm. and we understand that, so that anything that is said from this point, that has to be kept in mind. Mm-hmm. I believe that the war in Vietnam... They often call it immoral, whatever. I see it as being a political game that our military was placed in a very, very difficult and very awkward situation.
Mm-hmm.
We were invited, in my understanding, is that we were invited to go to Vietnam as advisors. And that we were not in any way having any expansion theories as far as taking over a foreign power like colonialism,
mm-hmm.
you know, or anything like that. So I don't think our being there was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was immoral about the Vietnam War was the games that were played in Washington, the politics, the lack of support.
Mm-hmm.
There is no reason that the United States could not have won that war
mm-hmm.
If the military would have had the political support it needed. Totally am against the anti-war protesters here in the United States, because I think they were manipulated. I think they were puppets. I don't think that many of them, even though they think they had an understanding, I don't think that they had an understanding at all of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very much against the anti-war protests that took place here in the United States. I was very much against the lack of support that the military had in Vietnam. When we were bombing Haiphong Harbor, from my Vietnamese friends that I have talked to since then, they said if we would have kept it up another week, that would have been the end, because they had absolutely, we were devastating them. They just could not have kept it up. But because of the political actions
that
took place, we stopped bombing,
mm-hmm.
and it saved their life.
Mm-hmm. But what was their life?
What was their life?
What were those people in North Vietnam trying to do?
They were trying to reunite their country.
Is that a bad thing?
No, that's not a bad thing, but under communism it is.
And now communism is?
And communism hasn't worked anywhere. We know that.
Right.
And it's not working in Vietnam. And what they had, what happened after Vietnam was far worse than what happened during the war. I mean, Cambodia with their genocide practically that took place.
But that wasn't
No, but I mean, it was all part of that whole thing. You can't separate them.
No, no, but on the other hand, we're still talking about
right. I think that there were more people. Oh, they, because see, I don't think that we ever were against Vietnamese independence.
No, we just didn't want them independent with communist
leaders. Communists.
Right.
And
so you think, getting back to the actual point, which is you believe, leaving the morality and everything else aside, that the United States had a right to determine what kind of government the people of Vietnam would have, whether their country would be divided or not.
Well, I don't think that the United States had the right to do that without being asked to interfere. And I do think that we were asked to help.
Okay.
And
just for the fun of it, by a government that we created.
Well, but there was nothing there beforehand, you know, to speak of. I'm
was
trying
there
to remember.
To be?
I'm trying to remember what was going on. Mm-hmm. And my.
Oh, it doesn't matter. This isn't a political discussion.
Yeah, I'm trying
I'm just
to remember
trying to flesh
that.
Out some,
right.
some of your impressions.
No,
the way you thought
I
about.
Think that. I saw it as ultimately good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
that's good. That's good. Yeah.
And it was, and I'm a person that will try to simplify things down to a point that you can see a clear decision.
Mm.
Okay, and I'm not saying there's no gray areas, certainly, but I certainly think that if the South Vietnamese did not want to be communists. And as I say, all the people that I came in contact with, the local people, they were all against communism.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not want to have a communist government.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw that as supporting that point of view. And here again, I went out into the country oftentimes and visited in smaller villages, you know, not just in Quy Nhon, and I never had a feeling of being, of people being unfriendly, of not wanting us there.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt anti-Americanism the time that I was in Vietnam, and it seems to me that if we were doing something that these people didn't want us to do, that there would be some overtones of displeasure with the people that they came in contact with.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Although, of course, no one would overtly, in your presence, it would be very hard for a villager outside those areas to accept.
Right, and
seen as an anti-government act, and they'd be
right.
Really
but you get you
oh,
have
I agree
a sense
with you.
Of hostility. I mean, it doesn't make any difference whether
right.
you even speak the same language
oh, yes.
or not.
Oh, I understand.
You can certainly pick up those vibrations if you have any intuitive sense
right.
at all. And I never, ever, ever had any feeling of anti-Americanism during the time that I was in Vietnam. Oh, I saw it as a struggle between communism versus not communism.
Mm-hmm.
And I had studied political science enough in college and certainly didn't at 22. How much experience did I have? I mean, I'm not, making that point. But I felt that it was... when you had to make a choice, you fought against communism.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that was what was going on there.
And you felt that when you got there
right.
and the whole time you're standing.
Yeah.
That's fine. By the way, the Haiphong, the bombing,
yes,
that was made possible by a deal cut with China, that the United States could apply greater pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the reason why we didn't do those things earlier was because of a fear that they would lead to a wider war with China.
I remember that.
And it doesn't mean that it would have.
Right.
It was up to the presidents of the United States to determine whether that risk was worthwhile, because of the anti-war movement. They felt it wasn't worthwhile.
Yeah. I think that anti-war movement, in most cases, they were just...
The headquarters of it was, of course, at Michigan State University, I thought, which is an irony of the... Not the headquarters. There was no headquarters,
right.
which makes it interesting.
Right.
But the teach-ins were very important.
I thought that was... I felt that 99% of the people that were involved truly did not understand the issues, and the other... 1% were the puppeteers pulling the strings, making things happen.
Well, you'd be surprised if you read some literature on the anti-war movement. It's probably very different from what you think, but it's not.
No,
we're not
but
interested
that's,
here. That's what you felt.
Yeah,
it's still feeling. That's fine.
And so I do not feel that we were there in a manner that was I'm not saying what we did was not inappropriate, but I don't think our presence was inappropriate, and I don't think that, and I probably always harbor a, will always harbor a slight resentment against those anti-war protesters. Probably. I mean, not an overt, you know, strong kind of thing, but like, you know.
Well, Senator McCain, John McCain, spent something like 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton. The thing is, if there wasn't an anti-war movement and he didn't respect it, wasn't fighting to defend America in Vietnam.
Right.
So he felt that although he wouldn't agree with the dissenters,
right,
he would be in a POW camp to defend that right of dissent.
And so, I agree with that point of view.
And the interesting thing is there has been no war in American history that has not been protested.
That's true.
By massive numbers, except the Second World War. Which
and even that
was... Yes, but even that war was the one in everyone's memory. So it seemed like that's the way American wars are always fought, for the complete support of the American people. You don't even have to tell them much.
Right.
They'll all just fall into line. And that, in a sense...
And that's wrong, absolutely.
Well, it set the stage for the anti-war movement, too. Because
right,
it became more and more clear that the war was fought in a very odd way.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
that
it's
the government
ridiculous
wasn't forthcoming. But unfortunately, the military went along with it. By
I can see that.
Because after the war, all the military said, you guys didn't let us win. And they wrote all these books that said that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, none of them said...
Sometimes it's so hard to see the forest for the trees.
Oh, yeah.
You
yeah
know, and
yeah,
when you're right immersed in something and you
right
don't have any perspective...
That's true.
You know, that
true
makes it difficult.
But when your command
difficult
is dying...
Yes.
Know,
when
your responsibility for lives, and that responsibility, unfortunately, for many command officers became...
Failures.
They said, I don't care what it's doing. I want a good report.
Right.
And they got that throughout Vietnam.
Well, and that was a character flaw on their
the
individual
whole
part, and then and a larger,
yes,
you know, a larger
it
issue.
It stretched from battalion commanders all the way up to the White House.
Right.
So
yeah.
I agree
with that. I have no problem with that.
Oh, no, it doesn't matter if you do or not. It's
no, but I mean,
fun, this dialogue.
Right.
As a teacher, I love to revel in the complexities.
Right.
And Vietnam is this full of complexities.
Right.
And you've actually stated that very nicely, too. But we're not, I mean, I was just interested. Many IVSers, for example, later, after you, were pacifists who wanted to do something in Vietnam but not connected with the military.
Mm-hmm.
The military, they wouldn't want anything to do with them. They
mm-hmm
wanted to see themselves as different.
Mm-hmm.
In the early years, the issues of the war weren't that clear, and the membership of IVS was quite different. There
mm-hmm
were people of much more... There's no war yet to radicalize them.
Well,
you know, like
there
that
was a war,
so you're
but
in
it
between
wasn't...
Yeah.
It was,
but it wasn't radicalized.
It wasn't,
right?
No.
Whereas
no
you're in this in-between thing where your
right
outlook and your... Your what do you call it? Desire to know and experience things
right
took you to the kind of mental exploratory thing that younger people, you know, people who would follow you would have.
Mm-hmm.
But you come from a political background and an immediate experience that was more akin to that earlier group. So it's
mm-hmm
a very interesting. You occupy an interesting place in
a
that
place
in that in
a
that,
transition.
That well, it, yeah, if there was one, I think
yeah
there was always all of these values present in IVS people. There were and your work. You were a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now first you probably had to learn some Vietnamese, and I know
yes
you got some Vietnamese instruction. Where did
right
you have that?
In Saigon, mm-hmm Chi Bui.
Bui Chi. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just saw him in Washington in April,
mm-hmm,
and so now he goes Chi Bui, but you know, before it was Bui Chi.
Mm-hmm.
And
is his son named Dooley, or is that a nephew? Does that ring a bell?
No, it doesn't ring a
okay
bell.
Because
I don't know.
There's one. There, he teaches Vietnamese at the Monterey, at the language school in Monterey.
Ah, okay.
And I was just trying to think. Well, I wonder if he's shouldn't be, but now that you've mentioned
right,
that,
I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Chi was our instructor
mm-hmm
and wonderful, dynamic human being. I just I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, as a friend. I
mm-hmm
mean, you know. I just really, really liked and respected him, and he was our instructor. And he taught us many things besides just the language. I mean,
mm-hmm,
you know, there was just his whole personality was, he was a perfect person for that kind of job because
mm-hmm
he was not too reticent to deal with Americans, which oftentimes a Vietnamese might hold back because American personalities are much more exuding. And, but Chi, he matched. I mean, it was, you know, very, very good. And, I think we were in Saigon 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then not literally, but figuratively, we were put on an airplane and dropped by parachute to Queen Yan. We did not, which was fine. We did fine, and I think that was, we never felt a strong support from the Saigon IVS people. Mm-hmm. Larry Laverance, Dick Kirsted, who by that time was USAID, but he had been IVS.
That's K-I-R-K-S-T-E-A-D.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Dick Kirsted. He lives in Pesca Forest.
I've met him.
Okay. Oh, yes. And I still correspond with him.
He's wonderful.
Yes, he's a wonderful man. And let's see, Larry Laverance, Dick Kirsted, and John Whitmer.
How do you spell that? W-H-I-T-M-E-R,
maybe?
Okay.
Maybe, I'm guessing.
Look for him.
Yeah. They were in Queen Yan. Mm-hmm. And so we were staying at a hotel that by any standards was a flop house. And there was no screens on the windows. There were just bars on the windows, you know. And I think the door had a padlock and two beds that were like just boards with a very thin mattress and mosquito nets, you know. And so that's where we stayed until we could find our house. But we ate with the IVS guys, Dick Kirsted, mm-hmm. John, and Larry. And we had our meals at Dick's house, as a matter of fact. He had a cook, and so, you know, we would go there for our meals, and she would prepare everything. So that was fun, and that was very nice. I enjoyed, because of my background and a lot of the background of the IVS men being more agriculture, as you had mentioned, there was never a strong camaraderie. We got along really well, and with Larry and John and Dick, and there was never any problem, but there was never that connection. Mm-hmm. Probably with Dick, there was more of a connection because after 34 years, we're still sending Christmas cards. Mm-hmm. But it was like we were from different planets. Mm. I don't know how to explain that. But it wasn't anything that was angry or anything. It was nothing like that. It was just that we were so different as far as...
Well, if you could meet, if someone studying the IVS experience, if they could meet someone like Dick Kirsted, who's a very nice person.
Right.
But is in a totally different universe from someone like you. You're just very urbane, I think is the best word of putting it. And they were not. They were very from rural backgrounds.
Right.
And they were outward looking. I mean, that's why they were in Vietnam,
right.
You know, but they just lived in a
different
world.
We were just on different planets, you know.
Did Billie Lee feel the same way?
Yes. Yeah, she did. She felt very much the same way. She came from an interesting background.
We're talking about Billie Lee Langley, who was Betty's roommate.
Right. And she had lived in Saudi Arabia. And so she had come and had gone to school in Switzerland.
Did her father work for Aramco?
Aramco, right. And so she came from a very different background than any of us did, and but she and I connected just like that, probably because of that, I don't know, because we had more of a city kind of background, I guess, I don't know. Anyway, so she and I were roommates, and that was a very, very excellent choice because there were three women, so they were going to put two together and one was off on her own. And we didn't know how that was all going to come out in the wash, you know, when we first got to Saigon. But as it turned out, they put Billie Lee and I together, and we have been lifelong friends. And she's a wonderful, wonderful person. And we see things oftentimes from a different perspective, but we, like I hope I am with everybody, to some extent, are very tolerant of different opinions. So that's fine. You don't have to have the same opinion, but it's more important that you have one than to have one that agrees with mine, you know, that kind of thing. And so she and I roomed together. We got along famously because, this is interesting, from a personal point of view, because we did not want to offend anybody in the Vietnamese community, because it was really important that we were respected and that we were thought of highly. But at the same time, we did not want to give up the invitations to the officers' club and to the stakes on Saturday night, that we would be invited to go out to the officers' club. We decided that we would do everything together. And so therefore, if Fred, when we first he first started coming by, he'd say, well, would you like to go off the officers' club Saturday night? And I'd say, Billy Lee and I'd love to.
He probably thought, when is she going to get rid of that woman?
And so therefore, we felt that it would be very difficult to compromise our morals, our integrity, anything that had to do with the Vietnamese community, which was very important, because we were always together.
Now, one question. When you went to Quy Nhon, did you, it was just you and Billy?
Right.
Anne was just, ended up...
She went, I think, to Hue.
Okay, great. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that's what we did. We stuck together. And so I don't think Fred saw me by myself for months, because we were always together. But you see, there that way, we didn't have to worry about the Vietnamese community, which was our prime concern, thinking that we were wild or loose or whatever. And then the second thing is, if IVS ever came back and had any comments, we could certainly stand up and vouch for each other, because we had been together, and we were having a heck of a good time, because we were able to take the best of two worlds, and thoroughly enjoy ourselves. And if you're the only two women in an officers' club and there's 40 or 50 officers, that's not too bad when you're, when you're 21 or 22 years old. And,
no, but as we talk, it becomes very clear that that the issue of women serving with IVS in Southeast Asia was always a problematic one.
Right.
And but the other nice thing was that basically IVS let things happen.
Right, and that's what they should
have. And you came to your, and locally, in fact, as the programs grew, more and more responsibility was put on the volunteers to work out their own problems.
Right, exactly.
And you're working out that problem culturally, so, you know, that's that was
it worked. It worked absolutely fine for us, because we never had any problem with the Vietnamese community. And Billy Lee taught at the normal school in Quy Nhon, and I taught at the high school. We, our students, as far as I know, were, and as far as attitude, were completely cooperative and very appreciative. And in fact, I heard from two of them this year.
Nice.
They're down in Florida, and two of them called. They got my number through Billy Lee. And they said, you know, I was in your class in Quy Nhon, and we are so happy to have your number and know where you are, and you know, how important your efforts to teach us English turned out to be, because we ended up coming to the United States. And it was wonderful, and it was a wonderful conversation. So I felt that we handled that very well, as far as the difference in cultures is concerned. I, when I went to Vietnam, and never intended to marry, I was sure I was going to be a single woman the rest of my life, because American men, and I don't mean to be offensive, that were in my age bracket had absolutely no interest to me at all, because I have such a strong personality that after a short period of time, I just lost interest in them, and they actually found me quite threatening, because you know, they just didn't know quite how to handle me. I guess
well, you're the only kind of women I'm interested in.
Yeah,
I married a one. So
right.
I'm
well, you see,
happy,
but you see,
yeah.
But you see, in the early '60s, for a 22-year-old woman to go to Vietnam, with a job, was pretty unusual, I think. And there wasn't one person in my environment that thought I should have gone, including my mother and dad. They were very, but my father...
But they didn't oppose it.
Oh, no, they didn't oppose it. They didn't stop it. They just said, are you sure you know what you're doing? And I said, no, probably I don't know what I'm doing, because I don't have any experience, but I know this is something that I want to do. And I have always been of the philosophy that you do what you need to do to make your life work, and if complications arise, you deal with them as best as you can, but you don't not do something because you're afraid mm-hmm. or because you're not sure of what the results are going to be, because mm-hmm. nobody has that crystal ball. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's always been my philosophy. So off to Vietnam I went, and with not one person saying, "Good for you, Betty. This is a good decision." Everybody's going, "Oh," wringing their hands. "Are you sure this is what you want?" And da 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 da. And it turned out to be absolutely the pivotal decision of my life, because my entire life changed from that moment that I arrived in Vietnam, and or made the decision, whichever way you want to look at it. And it all changed. It's been a wonderful life. I mean, I have absolutely loved my life, and love the people that have been in it and all the experiences that I've had. It's been really a very positive thing for me. So I see Vietnam as everything good for me personally, and hopefully I did some good for some of the other people.
Well, what were you? You were Billy Lee taught at a normal school, so we'll set that aside, but she's essentially teaching teachers.
Right.
And you were working at
high school.
At high school, but again, presumably your students in your class.
Oh, yes, before. Actually, they had a lot of grammar background. Their pronunciation was mm-hmm. abominable. Mm-hmm. And so basically what I was doing is working with the pronunciation. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I worked in conjunction with a Vietnamese teacher.
My next question.
Yes. And so that, you know, they could say, I mean, they could write a fairly good sentence, you know, or paragraph with the punctuation and everything, but you couldn't understand a word they said. So my job was to get that oral pronunciation, and the thing that they had the hardest time with, I'll always remember this, is the TH sound, because there's nothing equivalent to it in Vietnam, in the Vietnamese language, and they would either stick their tongue out so obviously that it was, you know, I mean, if you want to go, you know, mm-hmm. you just, it's just a error.
We're talking about thought.
Thought, right. Yes. Uh-huh. You're, that right. TH sound that right. is just air. Right. And so that, they go, you know, I mean, they'd go through all these things and we'd laugh and, you know, and try to, I always think that when there's a sense of humor involved in any process, that it is possible, obviously that not every process is possible, but when it can be introduced, that it's relaxing to the people that are involved, mm-hmm. and that you can make a point much easier. So we had a good time as we were teaching.
Do you remember any, besides the humor, which is,
you know,
essential, right,
right.
For language instruction, do you remember any techniques that, say, American oral teaching techniques that